You are listening to Radio Albion.
Everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date is the 16th of December, 2023. And of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. I've received some substantial donations recently, and I thank those people who know who they are. I encourage that behavior, of course, because not only does it insert you into this whole research mission as an integral part, but because I don't have your traditional backing of a university or foundation, those donations keep me from having to listen to anybody. And we're going to actually talk about this quite a bit today. And so for those two reasons, I certainly encourage you to continue to assist me, no matter how small. Certainly the sky's the limit if you're feeling generous. Since I restarted the Orthodox Nationalist back in whatever it was, 2016, I covered two theorists of the Russian monarchy, Dikhomirov and Solonovich. And I'm going to complete that trinity today with Nikolai Chernyayev. He is someone who is not nearly even in royalist circles as famous as the previous two. But in today's lecture, this is the third of the three great political philosophers of Russian royalism, and especially, you know, writing either at the time of the monarchy or within very recent memory of it. And so these three should be listened to probably in a series, even though they're several years apart from one another. And my very first book, The Third Rome, and yeah, there's cringy things in there. I was 29 or 30 years old when I wrote that. And the arguments I made there, the essentially that book was an outline of the defense of the Russian crown and the areas of my own research in the future. And I've stayed pretty close to that since 2000. Or something, 2001, whenever that was, 2001, when that was published by the Barnes Review. And the arguments for royalism, and I mean traditional royalism, the Byzantine and medieval version, rather than the so-called Hobbesian version that was in vogue when Peter the Great was running Russia. Most of the time, these writers were talking about Muscovite Russia, not what became a very different kind of government in state form in the floating city of St. Petersburg. Yet it still maintained some of the benefits of monarchy, especially after the 18th century. But Moscow was the core in both literal and symbolic senses. And I continue that research agenda here. Now, I'm going to start off with a quote from him, and it's his books and the secondary sources. There's nothing in English, as far as I know. I have the 1998 edition of his The Mysticism, Ideals, and Poetry of the Russian Autocracy, and then his book simply called Russian Autocracy, which comes from the Institute of Russian Civilization, and that was put out in 2011. The previous one put out in 1998. Of course, Chernyayev died in 1910, so he's roughly contemporary with the other two members of this trinity. But let me start it off this way. He says this in Russian Autocracy. He says, "There is nothing more erroneous than the prejudice by which an unlimited monarchy is considered synonymous with popular slavery, and a republican constitutional monarchy synonymous with freedom. The Moscow autocracy was a creation of a great Russian state genius or spirit. If Russia had not been under an unlimited monarchy, it would never have acquired world historical significance. Our autocracy is a mind and will of an entire nation, personified as one person. Russia will belong to the Russian people, who created the empire, only insofar as it is ruled by autocratic Russian monarchs. And that quote, which I'll come back to, is one of the core doctrines, almost the axiomatics of the royalist point of view in Russia in this era. I haven't done anything on this before, but there is an era in Russian literature and art called the Silver Age. The Golden Age was the era of Pushkin, but the Silver Age is essentially the last third of the 19th and the first 10 or 15 years in the 20th century. And the Silver Age, I think I've dealt with Sologub before, who's my favorite person from that era. You have a deep turn to the mystic or Platonic life, even with those who turned on Christianity. You have people like Andre Belli and so many others at the time, Adasovsky, who, eccentric as they were, took Plato as their guise. But there's plenty of philosophy in that era that's largely forgotten even in Russia itself. Tchernaev is one of them, extremely important for that revival in the last third of the 19th century in Russia. The Silver Age then gets treated in English, and I think in Russian too, as essentially a secular phenomenon, albeit a Platonic one. But remember, this is also the period of Optino. This is the period of the flowering of the Russian Orthodox Church, its missionary work, as Russia regained confidence that it had lost in during the 18th century, where the state simply ceased to exist for a while, no different than the Triumph of Troubles or the Mongol occupation or anything like that. And it doesn't often get treated that way, but people who've listened to me a long time are well aware that that's a big deal to me. What makes Nikolai Tchernaev important is that his research was basically the metaphysical foundations of the Russian crown. It's important to note that he was born into an old noble family, which is the case for a lot of these people, and he became a lawyer in Kharkov Imperial University, Kharkov being in eastern Ukraine today, but certainly a Russian-speaking area. And he went to St. Petersburg University to continue his studies. And the way that the degrees were granted back then are very different from what it is in America today. The master's thesis was considered far higher than it is in the U.S. But he wrote a thesis called the Zemensky Sobor of the Moscow State in the 16th and 17th centuries, an extremely important topic. Now, one of the members of his committee was Professor Ivan Dityatin, who was a complete modernist, who was very upset by the argument that Russians, despite being under a strong monarchy, were completely self-governing. He claimed that the centralization of the Moscow monarchs made it impossible for anyone to be self-governing, which today I don't think a whole lot of people would accept. The 19th, early 20th century liberal ideas have fallen apart. But Tchernaev, of course, did not agree. He said, you haven't proven your case. And so the Dyatin in 1878 filed a petition with the Board of Regents, or whatever they were called back then, at Kharkiv to get him removed. Something that I know a thing or two about. And they failed to do that when I was at Nebraska, but they've succeeded with others. But it shows you that he is a true rebel, because that's what happens to actual rebels. He was a man of great integrity. He'd rather be thrown out, maintaining this cohesive point of view, than remain without it. And that book and those that came out of it even predated the other two men I mentioned, Tikhomirov and Solonovich's book, The Popular or People's Monarchy. So he couldn't do the academic thing anymore, which shows you, even, you know, the late 19th century, the media and the academies were run, unless they were specifically religious, and even then, were run by many, many modernists. If you could be thrown out for that, then the rot in late Russian noble society was severe. This is why people like Alexander III and Nicholas II were so important. But he was a lawyer. And he, rather than the purely academic life, he went into activism, journalism, not unlike me. And he was part of a publication called the Southern Regions, and wrote a number of both religious and political works there, from the Kharkov Chronicle. He spoke of Archbishop Filaret, who came to that see for a while and was an important figure in popularizing St. John of Kronstadt. He did have a very early sketch of him about his miracles and everything else. John of Kronstadt also was a royalist and nationalist activist and visited Kharkov in 1890 and visited that very newspaper. And so he began to build his name in these circles. There really was never a cohesive single organization dedicated to defending the monarchy. The Union of the Russian People was the closest thing, of course, the church as a whole. But even in the February Revolution, many churchmen signed on to the provisional government, which is a terrible thing, but certainly nothing as bad as signing on to the Soviet government, the October Revolution. But in 1890, he was promoted at least in prestige, to work at the journal Russian Review, which was probably the flagship publication among Russian monarchists. And that's when he published, in 1895, his book, The Russian Autocracy, or On the Russian Autocracy. That is the very first systematic work defending the monarchy in Russia, predating both Solonovich and Tikhomirov. He wrote a few other things, The Necessity of Autocracy for Russia, but he stopped collaborating, despite the fact that he was working for the Russian Review. The Southern Regions newspaper was taken over by leftists, and he didn't write for them anymore. And then Nikolai Ivanovich Chernayev became a member, an active member, of the so-called Russian Assembly in Kharkov, and you know, the nationalist movement among Russians took place in what we call Eastern Ukraine and New Russia today. And you had this small core of writers, usually sometimes working with the Black Hundred, sometimes not, who argued the absolute necessity of autocracy. I mean, when he says unlimited, that might be translated as absolute, but we realize that's simply a hypothetical. Of course, it's never, no one could rule absolutely, only God can. But to some extent, the monarchy is meant to be a hypostasis of God. The Russian Orthodox Church and the autocracy, especially the Muscovite version, was the very backbone of the Russian state. Russia would not have existed, maybe at all, if the state didn't coalesce as the, you know, in the 16th and late 15th century. You have a lot of people, like A. Vasilev, who wrote an excellent secondary source, which I've read on this topic, and he says that essentially what Chernayev did is create a mystical poetic concept of the Russian autocracy. And he also says that this is one of the first systematic works on the basic principles and foundations of Russian legal consciousness as a royalist thing. And it really, I guess if you want to add another name, Ivan Ilyin would be the final one of the four. But he was writing in exile, of course, where he was writing after the USSR. So he's much later than that, the three that I mentioned already. And of course, nothing proves the thesis that Russia could not exist without the monarchy or something like the monarchy as the February and October revolutions and the extreme instability of the Soviet Union from the moment it was established. Remember, you had the Civil War continued throughout the Russian countryside straight up until World War II. Oleg Platonov makes that argument. That regime was never as secure as they wanted the Western world to think. But unity and the unshakable tradition exists only because of the monarchy. And of course, vice versa. Anytime the autocracy weakens, Russia is in serious trouble. That's what happened in the 18th century. That's what happened. Well, it actually got started in the Mongol era. Anytime you had this power vacuum without a strong monarch, the time of troubles is another example. Or when there's some confusion as to who should rule, everything changes. Without Tsar Nicholas, the entire edifice of the Russian royal state, or the Russian state period, came crashing down. Vasilev saw Chernayev as a prophet, because without the crown, the Orthodox faith cannot penetrate the population as much as it would like to, and the Russian nation is in serious trouble. Now, theologically, it's one of the reasons he's called this mystic poetic theorist. The fundamental statement is that monarchy, in the form that developed 16th century in Russia, 17th century, the Byzantine Empire, Bulgarian Empire, Serbian Empire, that kind of imperial royalism is the only one that's consistent with the Christian point of view. It was established in the Old Testament, as we all know. I've been through this many times. And he even goes so far as to say the commandment to serve Caesar or to give Caesar what is his was its version in the New Testament. I'm not sure if the give to Caesar what is Caesar works. I don't know what he meant specifically by Caesar. Did he mean a successor to the Romans, as Russia truly was? Because it's always been my contention that you don't get a dose of politics in the New Testament, because the Old Testament already did it. It already laid down the foundations. And he says, Christianity in its spirit cannot encourage and develop republican, democratic, or oligarchic instincts. Nominalism, which is atheist almost by its structure, although there are some exceptions to that, can't work with a royalist system in the traditional medieval sense. It can in the Hobbesian sense, although Thomas Hobbes did not promote monarchy by any means. And the alternative is too monstrous, and everyone knows exactly what happens when that crown weakens. Using foreign models, pretending to correct the historical experience of Russia with abstractions, is an error. And the academics and the journalists, due to their ignorance and what he calls their frivolity, he says, our reformers did not delve into the depths of time and draw their transformative plans from the tradition, but only from newspapers, from the most common brochures and textbooks on state law, supplementing their lightweight erudition with their pleasure trips abroad. So he had that very acidic, sarcastic point of view. In other words, these people are deeply alienated from Russia. from Russian history, and to a great extent, the church. They become these cosmopolitan, wealthy figures who visit Paris and London all the time and see them as the height of sophistication. Therefore, the only way that they can talk about politics is through abstractions, rights or equality, or any term like that that's not connected with an actual way of life. I've said this before, and it really is a law of political science, that an ideologist can lay out a beautiful statement of basic political principles and what needs to be done and how it's to be done. But the minute that view, you know, forms a party and somehow takes over the government and imposes that, everything changes. It's not this beautiful thing anymore. Words have to be translated into actions of millions of people and institutions, and all the dirt that politics always kicks up. So the difference between an ideology, even a good one, on paper, in language, is very different from when it gets imposed on a population. And the more alien it is from the Russian nation's experience, the more violence has to be used to impose it. Russia in the 19th century became a civilization unto itself. I could go back to Ivan the Terrible for that, or the wedding of Ivan the Third with the Byzantine princess. These are these watershed moments. But either way, it's the royalist form of government is what brought this about. And again, whenever that weakens, Russian statehood begins to collapse in on itself. I'm going to quote him again, and he asks the question, what explains how the Tsar's power in Russia grew stronger over time, despite the fact that it had to deal with such periods of nihilism as a time of troubles? And his answer, the fact that the Russian autocracy developed organically in Russia, that it took deep roots in Russian soil and fully meets the needs of the Russian nation, as were determined by the interaction of geographical, ethnographic, historical, and cultural conditions. Only gross ignorance and narrow dogma can consider our autocracy as a matter of chance or something that could be changed or eliminated at will. Now let me compare that answer, that quote, with a quote from Solonovich in his The People's Monarchy. He says, Russian statehood has grown on the soil, not burdened by any ideological dream. It developed organically. It did not know either the Inquisition or the religious wars. Our schism was only a very faint repetition of the struggle between Protestantism and Catholicism, and what the Nikonian Church did to the old believers could not be compared remotely to St. Bartholomew's Night or the exploits of the Spaniards in the Netherlands. Most importantly, Russia, before Peter the Great, did not know serfdom. In other words, those two citations are extremely are similar and make a very similar argument. The difference, of course, is that Solonovich stressed the idea that Peter the Great did create a revolution. Certainly a political one, but almost completely a social one and an economic one. And of course, you have to use force for that. It's no different than Petersburg being built on probably one of the worst areas to work, using the Cossacks to kill them. Literally, the city is built on the bones of old Russia. That same kind of force you need to build something like that there, the swamps everywhere, it's frozen all the time, is exactly the type of force you need to use to impose an ideology on a population alien to its tradition. So, the nature of the state in the Russian case, from its very inception, really, doesn't derive from abstract doctrine. It doesn't derive from the state of nature mythology. But, as I've said a million times, the interplay of just these significant variables in its environment. In my first book, I spoke of the short growing season in most of Russia, So there's a small window to grow food. It's vulnerability from many different directions, among other things, that built the specific form of the Russian state that developed from Ivan Kalita onward. Yeah, people share a single human nature, but the way a nation develops has many variables working on. As he said, you know, cultural, ethnographic, historical, geographical. And of course, the economy is going to follow that as well. Manifesting that single human nature is going to be very different over time. Not to mention the simple fact that contrary to the myths that are promoted in universities today, the Russian monarchy was both politically and economically successful. And this is why it was necessary for the wealthy in foreign countries to create a very cohesive conspiracy to destroy it. But he makes reference to the gross ignorance, he says, and the narrow doctrinaire outlook. But that's exactly what he says is prevalent amongst the intelligentsia. The minute they lost their Christian conscience, they immediately became anti-Russian and certainly anti-monarchist. I'm going to quote Chernayev again. Our society, generally speaking, is still vaguely aware of the tasks of its homeland and therefore is often carried away by anti-Russian aspirations. The Decembrists seriously dreamed of dismembering Russia into its component parts. In the early 1860s, sympathy for Polish claims was considered a sign of good manners and sophistication. Ivan Aksakov once said, "Russify yourself." And if you do that, you will easily Russify our foreigners. Now, I've always maintained that Russification was a wild exaggeration, but because foreign powers were financing revolutionaries in Poland and Finland and any other place they possibly could, even Ukraine to a lesser extent, Russia had to respond in kind. It's exactly what the monarchy did. Liberalism, as I've maintained since I was 18 years old, is not so much an ideology, but simply reflective of the destruction of the of reason and of the cultural tradition in which liberals are born and raised. It derives from isolation, it derives from alienation, and the rejection of history, of really having any importance into understanding how states would function. Only when the crown fell was Russia and Ukraine to experience the nature of genocide. So to say to Russify yourself is to say that being Russian is a frame of mind. It's to build a thorough knowledge of Russian history, not the historiography that liberals and Marxists put out in very general terms. You don't have a feudalism in Russia as you did in France. You didn't have it in Scandinavia either. But these oversimplistic categories really fill in for ignorance and laziness. We know how the West does history, and it's encapsulated in the phrase Whig history. It's a method, it's a historiography that tries to show that all previous institutions come and go, I mean previous to the modern age, in a mechanism of progress bringing all of mankind to liberal capitalism. In other words, everything that exists is a chain of causality leading to the rule of usury. Liberal capitalism and usury are basically the same thing. Not entirely, but basically. Now, the conception of education, and I think I've mentioned this before, education isn't necessarily book learning. And this is not necessarily for a specific field, but for citizenship in general. The people, that is to say, the so-called uneducated peasants, are the ones who understand, at least instinctively, Russian history far better than a lot of the nobles did at the time. There was a distortion even a substitution of the concept of what an education is. So the intelligentsia is literate, and they read books by fashionable and sophisticated Western authors. But the peasants in this same era didn't read sophisticated literature. They could, however, read symbols, and their knowledge was instinctive. What was lost in the Soviet era, the peasant knowledge of the earth, peasant knowledge of animals, is beyond anything that exists today. But those who are reading books idealizing Western systems, already alienated from their own country, created an inferiority complex. This is how Peter the Great justified his imposition and his violence in what really could be considered the first Russian Revolution. Now, book learning is extremely important, especially if you're an academic. But education, in the broadest sense, is the formation of an actual person, not an ego. A person, a citizen, immersed in a holistic vision of the world based on knowledge of God and what that means for moral and natural laws. In other words, education actually was applied to the semi-literate peasants, and the literacy rates were much higher than is normally reported. But education in that sense was almost completely absent within the intelligentsia. One of the reasons that their so-called to the people movement failed is that these people had no idea. They dressed up in peasant clothing with the idea that, well, the peasants are stupid. We're the sophisticated ones. We'll convince them that their way of life is false and build what later became the collective farm. And I will take an aside here. It took me a while to figure this out. But you have a to the people movement in America. Some of these environmentalists talk about the return to farming, return to the land, return to organic methods of production. But how is that congruent with their liberal leftist ideology? Well, in the same way that the collective farm was connected to the commune. They substitute one for another. The farms that these people want to create would be totalitarian experiments, very much like the collective farm. Now, they're not going to reflect the so-called values of the peasantry or of the countryside. They despise that. And you had the same thing with the to the people movement, thinking that, of course, actual farmers are at the time were ignorant. And of course, they were landowners in many senses of that term. And it's one of the reasons why it failed completely and why these people were usually turned over to the nearest police agency. In other words, they were the peasantry. Understanding the liturgy and the symbols was far more educated than the completely symbolically illiterate intelligentsia. People who latched on to anything fashionable from Paris or London, which is not a positive thing. Their alienation is their problem. They simply don't understand the patrimony that they're giving up. So the education of a nation is connected with a very profound moral and religious worldview and upbringing. You know, Aristotle talks about this, the need for examples of having virtuous behavior almost become a matter of instinct. Let me quote Chernyayev again from the same book. The Russian people are monarchists to the marrow of their bones, and long ago has internalized royalist beliefs, having forgotten the earlier appanage order and appanage freedom, which often turned into confusion and anarchy. Speak to a Russian peasant about the state structure of Russia and other lands, and you will be convinced that he only honors autocracy and does not want any other regime. One of the most obnoxious aspects of the left in different periods in history is their assumption that they could speak for the downtrodden. We know what the left believes about the family farm and religious values and everything that true agrarianism, they absolutely despise it. And they despise it to a great extent because they don't know anything about it. But, of course, the peasants were royalist because they associated the crown, who did not rule them directly. Their commune and the county government ruled them directly, in which they played a huge part. They associated the crown with Russia herself. And these become instinctual. They become they may not be able to write a treatise about it, but their understanding is even deeper than that. Russia is simply too big and too exposed to external invasion for anything other than a royal government. The fact that Petersburg is so far from Moscow made that move absolutely ridiculous, and it did a great degree of damage to the Russian Empire. Put differently, the same people who were so deeply alienated, if not contemptuous, of Russia, that's probably the last group of people who should be ruling it. But, the peasants had this instinct, this orthodox instinct, this royalist one. It's the result of repeated historical experiences. It becomes a part of the blood. It becomes part of the land that they farm. But as far as authority goes, not power as such, but as far as authority goes, it's even deeper than that because you have the Trinitarian and a Christian understanding of what authority really is. I'm going to quote him again. Christianity had no need to give the world any new political ideal of the organization of states. It was already written in the Old Testament. King David and other wise and pious Old Testament kings were revered by Christians. The anointed kings are the rulers to whom Christians gravitate more than to any other rulers. By commanding that the things that are Caesar's be rendered unto Caesar, Jesus thereby pronounced a condemnation of uprisings against him and any encroachments on his rights. So, as I mentioned before, he's taking the word Caesar quite literally. Now, I don't believe there's a connection between Caesar and Tsar, as many people believe. I don't think that's the case. I've dealt with that elsewhere. But he's talking about Roman power, and Roman power certainly from Byzantium to Moscow as the Third Rome is what Christ meant by Caesar. There may be some truth to that. But the very idea of Rome, so despised by the Talmud, had a tremendous impression upon everyone that came under its sway. Even in the West, up until the Enlightenment, it was the standard of political legitimacy. So as the Western world, the elites in Paris, London, Antwerp, turned to Judaic usury, and thus plutocracy, Russia became the bulwark against revolution. The only political systems that the Old Testament accepts in a positive way is royalism, royal states. And then it works in reverse. He says, history itself shows that autocracy can only be where there is orthodoxy. This generalization is true and is applied to the Christian world as a historical law. All Russian history serves as proof of the inextricable connection that exists between orthodoxy and the absolute monarchy. I use the word hypostasis before, certainly not in the same sense that Christ used it. But you had plenty of church fathers under the original Roman Empire who spoke of the emperor as almost a hypostasis of either Christ or the Trinity as such. But you consider the enemies of not just the Russian crown, but crowns in general in Europe and Eastern Europe, you see that it's the same drive to usury, banking centralization, and all the rest. These people who absolutely despise the break that a monarch puts on the development of those kind of organizations. Every leftist in Europe, in the 19th century despise and would do anything to destroy the monarchies of that continent. So Tchernaev stresses the connection, and I do this myself, between natural law and Orthodox theology. Natural law is part of human nature. It's implanted on us. You know, we're social. We need to be able to work. We need to be able to at least have subsistence, families, and child rearing. These aren't options. These are a part of what it is to be human, and therefore they're the foundations for any political rule. But even though I don't want to get too abstract here, because it's historical experience that matters. I defined nationalism in the past, ethno-nationalism is really what I'm talking about, as the rule of the structures of survival. In other words, what are those things that came into existence in the worst and lowest time of a people? Just like a family, the more pain it goes through, generally speaking, the stronger it becomes. They end up hanging on to each other for dear life. And the same thing goes with nations. So it was the Serbs throughout the Turks. It was the nation, and of course the church was a big part of the nation, that, you know, was the weapon. There's nothing else that can fight imperialism, and including the imperialism of the liberal powers today, other than the nation. Liberalism, Marxism, all believe that economics, self-interest, is enough to hold the society together. And of course, that's a complete lie. But Tchernaev says it was the constant danger from external invasion, from the moment, essentially, you know, Russia was founded, in, say, let's say the Kievan era, to the time that he's writing. That was the impetus that created a strong Russian autocracy. Now, today, of course, liberal democracies are intensely centralized. I mentioned that the monarchy didn't directly rule the peasantry, and that's certainly true. Politics was considered a much more narrow field, having mostly to do with foreign policy and basic collection of taxes. Everything else was done at the local level. And unlike in the West, the local level in Russia was extremely popular. The commune was the institution. So Tchernaev says simply, if the autocracy didn't come into existence, Russia would never have united into one political organism. It's the autocracy. Those princes became the gatherers of the Russian land, as we say. I'm going to quote him here again. Unconstrained by either the whims of the people or the oligarchic claims of the boyar clans, they, meaning the monarchs, could steadily follow the once-mastered system and achieve their goals from generation to generation, taking advantage of all the benefits of their position. And this gave them enormous advantages over their rivals and enemies. In the Moscow autocracy lies the key to the triumph that ended Russia's many years of struggle with its age-old enemies, such as the Tartars and the Poles. If royal power had not fallen so low in Poland, it would not have been easy for Russia to break the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and first tear Little Russia away from it, and then in the 18th century begin to divide the remaining lands of the Polish crown. Russia fought Poland acting as one man, unquestioningly obeying the orders of the Tsarist government. The Poles, on the other hand, tied their king's hand and foot, committed outrages in their legislatures, and valuing most of all the liberties of the elite, brought their armed forces to absolute squalor. If you could summarize my basic point of view, and I think it's the same for Tchernaev and others, into one sentence, or a few sentences, turning it into a slogan, it would be something like, at any given moment, and this is a part of human nature, any given moment, nations, ethnic groups, have to make a choice. And that choice is between monarchy and oligarchy. There really is nothing in between, and there's nothing outside of that dyad. So using the Polish example, which he uses here, Poland was a, of course, pre-modern society that, because the Jews were brought in to rule the cities, there was a minimal connection between the crown and the elite in the Polish countryside. The Jews became clients of the nobility, and so eventually became very powerful, and this is what drove the growth of the Polish Empire. It was an oligarchy, a deeply divided one. The Polish elite would rather lose, would rather be destroyed in battle than have a victory against its enemies. That leads to the increase of the prestige of the crown. Poles tied their kings hand and foot. What that means is that the oligarchy was so obsessed with holding on to power and the money and the lands it had that they never gave their monarch, even in wartime, the power that he needed. And this is what brought that country to destruction. This is what brought the country to destruction, the fact that it never had a unified political system but was a set of ad hoc arrangements among powerful noble families. And this argument is both in defense of the realm from outside invaders, as well as the creation of social unity inside. So man has a choice to make, either monarchy in one form or another, and I include, you know, strong presidents and military governments in there too, dedicated to the common good, or republican oligarchy, dedicated to the good, the oligarchs and the plutocrats, although using the language and rhetoric of, you know, this universal common good. In the Russian case, one of the dominant historical examples was the era of the supremacy of Kiev, and to a lesser extent, Galicia. I mentioned the word apanage before, and quoting him, and that was the highly decentralized focus of rule prior to the Mongols, where princes tended to be semi-absolute only in their little principalities. So when a strong force comes from the outside, they fell to pieces. The only thing that mattered in Kiev was local interest. Strength would be had as Kiev grew in power, but eventually they had to leave that regime, and the Moscow idea, royalist idea, began in Vladimir Suzdal. So in the Kievan era, it was the self-interest of these small and often petty princes. And they fought one another, as you would expect. And that's what, and you see, it wasn't even an oligarchy. You know, it was an oligarchy technically, but it wasn't a plutocracy. Now, in Novgorod, you had a clear oligarchy and plutocracy. The only people who mattered were wealthy merchants, who basically enslaved the common population of Novgorod. That's that one of the foundational republican systems. But when that city was broken, Ivan III, you heard Ivan the Terrible, when that city was broken, it fell and became part of the Moscow, it was always Russian, but became part of the Moscow kingdom because the lower classes had risen up against their masters. But the crown, it wasn't as if, and you know, I've spoke about the development of Moscow so many times, it wasn't like they had a blueprint as to how this state was going to develop. No, it came and went according to historical events. Had the crown not existed the way it developed in Suzdal and later transferred to Moscow, Russia could never have come into existence. It would end up in the same way that Poland or Khazaria or even the Italian city-states in the north. So the unity of the state under the crown is a mirror of the unity of the Orthodox Empire and the Russian population, that is to say, the Russian Narod. And then Chernyayev says something very interesting. I'm not quoting him here. This is the basic thrust. Because of the fact that the crown was an organic development, it wasn't simply imposed on Russia like William was imposed on Britain. It wasn't this so-called superstructure that's imposed on the national organism. It was generated by that natural organism. A very, very different situation. That's why there's a close connection between the development of the Russian nation, which includes Ukrainian and Belarusian peoples to a great extent, and the crown. The Slavs were the dominant element by far. Other peoples lived a autonomous existence. But it was historical experience then. The development of the Russian nation, the Slavic nation, from that, and that's the source, the of the autocracy. In other words, the Russian state in that form was crystallized historical experience, congealed tradition. So Tsarnaev is going to say naturally that the Moscow autocracy was the creation of people who had internalized the historical development of their nation. And that autocracy is the reason why the great Russian tribe, so to speak, was the gatherer of Russian lands after the fall of the Kievan system and the weakening of the horde in certain places. You know, in the late 19th century, Ukrainian nationalists were very small in number. I mean, they had points, especially against Peter. I've spoken about that at great length. But Galicia was an extremely pro-Russian area. They wanted to destroy the tradition of the Poles. And I mean, it was, after all, in the battle for Orthodoxy against the Catholics that Western Slavic idea came into existence. And it's true, you had a different historical experience, although not all that different. They were forcibly separated. And it's only after Stalin that you had this, the development of the Ukrainian nation, which under the circumstances made perfect sense. It should have its own Orthodox Church and all the rest of it. But this is why it was the ethnos, the Russian ethnos, that was the attraction for both Belarusians and Ukrainians. You had more than 10 important specific ethnic groups within the empire, the overwhelming majority of whom asked to join the new state, as Georgia did, as Armenia did. They were never conquered. Yeah, Ivan the Terrible conquered Astrakhan, but this was the seat of the Volga-Bulgar oligarchy. We're constantly sending raiding parties into Russia. Georgia, because they were in an area that's very Islamic at the time, Armenia the same thing, needed the protection of the monarchy. And that's why the common population in those two countries are very pro-Russian. In other words, they became members of the Moscow Commonwealth, which is a phrase that I've coined, similar to the Byzantine Commonwealth. Poland, Finland, some of the Islamic republics are so autonomous in everything but foreign policy that they don't relate to Moscow or Petersburg in the way, say, Tallahassee relates to Washington, D.C. This is not the modern state that's operative here. Let me quote Tsarnaev again from the same book. Our ancestors could gather under one banner in moments of difficult trial. They can act energetically and in cooperation, even in the absence of the crown. Can fight effectively, but this was only in rare exceptional cases. For example, in 1612, and this couldn't last long. Life without the crown is fragmented, unaccustomed to joint activities, and a scattered population over vast spaces. But most of all, the psyche of the Russian people, the great Russian tribe, which has always thirsted for a living and firm power, being able to perfectly obey discipline, is by no means a tendency to directly interfere with the affairs of state. All this taken together determined the widespread development of autocracy in Rus and made it positively necessary for our homeland. The autocracy acts as a bridge among social groups in conflict, reduces to zero the unjust claims of individuals, tribes, classes, and region that make up the empire, forces everyone to serve the interests of state power and the common good, the prosperity, and turns the entire Russian nation into one huge political organism, unanimously striving for the realization of its historical vocation. Our autocracy is the mind and will of an entire nation personified in one person. The examples of Poland and Russia couldn't have been starker. The Polish oligarchy was absolutely unsustainable. And although it took a while, it fell apart in the late 18th century. So fragmentation was the enemy. The regime wants to occupy Russia today and divide her up into these constituent elements, because Russia now is too big, it could put up too much of a fight for the Great Reset. I've been saying that since the 90s. Therefore, to divide it up, install governments in the different areas, is the way that they have to deal with Russia. It isn't going to work, but it's been tried in the past, even in the distant past. The crown is at war with oligarchy. Military governments are at war with oligarchy. But without a constraining power like that, oligarchy is inevitable. Because of the specific geography and economy of Great Russia, Russians have always lived in a communal setting. In fact, pretty much everyone on the planet lived in a communal setting prior to the Enlightenment, because we're naturally communal. We are not meant to be alone. We can't function alone. We wouldn't survive infancy if we were alone. But those communities in the Russian case lasted far longer, because Russia didn't have the Enlightenment, as you call the February Revolution one. Those communities, whether it be the Artel in the cities, the peasant commune in the countryside, they were completely self-governing. Politics then became a narrow aspect of civic life, which means, and again, I made this argument in my first book too, autocracy didn't govern the nation, because overwhelmingly the nation governed itself. But as far as, it was the most effective organization of state life for higher level things, military policy, foreign policy, currency issues. Of course, always remained, as it did in Rome, in the hands of the monarch. And many times, the Russian state had to consult the Zemensky Sabor, that is to say, the council of the land, which were not represented by parties, but by the estates, the best representatives of all the classes in the estates of the realm. It would be peasants, townsmen, nobles, military, the church, etc. A party is a faction run by an oligarch that pretends to speak for the people as a whole. Estates, on the other hand, are actual social and functional interests, needed social functions. You know, whether it be industry, agriculture, science, each one of them is an estate that's completely self-governing. The Sobor has never been in Chernaya's mind. It's never a permanent institution. It's sort of like the judges in Israel. But oftentimes Russia had to turn to these when they found it necessary. Never even considered those decisions binding on them personally. But it is the closest thing to pure representation as you can get. County government is one step above the communal one. And as time goes on, these functions are gradually shifted to one place or another. So as the government became more complex, the crown was needed more than ever to maintain unity and stability within the inevitable chaos of factional politics. In other words, without the crown, in Russia or elsewhere, plutocracy and oligarchy are inevitable developments. They call themselves republican systems, but wherever they're found, they tend to be trading republics dedicated to usury and the rule of financial power. Even the Vieja in the Kievan era ruled side by side with the princes, traced back to their Rurikids. The establishment of autocracy and the transformation of those former sovereign princes into those who served the common good of the Tsar, that's when Russia became a great power. The unity of the crown was necessary to mobilize resources, including human resources, to build a thriving economy out of, in many cases, a very difficult climate, both political and geographic. I mentioned the quote above, "There's nothing more erroneous than the prejudice by virtue of which an unlimited monarchy is considered synonymous with popular slavery, and a republic synonymous with the opposite." He also states that the power of the Russian emperor, in essence, is no different from the prerogatives entrusted to the most liberal of constitutions, to those in charge of legislation and higher administration. In other words, law is still law, regardless of how you choose the government. Bureaucracy still functions the way it does, regardless of the form of government. The difference was, republicanism became the modernist creed, and as the Enlightenment worked its course and revolutions took place, the bureaucracies of Western Europe became humongous. In France, it was the urban bureaucracy of Paris that had more members than the entire federal bureaucracy in the Russian Empire, meaning the bureaucracy in St. Petersburg. And what happens in these historical discussions is that the ideals of liberal democracy are contrasted with the actual reality of royal rule. If they were to do the reality of liberal democracy versus the reality of Russian royalism, it's a different story. Never let anyone get away with talking about democracy or republicanism in these ideal terms. No, talk about how they actually function. Every conceivable kind of leftist rule has been tried since the dawn of the Enlightenment, and in every case, it's the same. The wealthy prosper, oligarchy and plutocracy result, and rather than labor in the common good, you have usury and Machiavelli. But even if that wasn't true, the assumption that things like autocracy or the total state are simply political categories. They're not. In the West, they're economic categories. Debt slavery comes as close to actual slavery as anything, as any other institution. It's not just a matter of politics. It's a matter of economics. If they were to introduce so-called representative institutions in Russia at the time that Chernyev is writing, he says it would give the entire nation into bondage to a very significantly wealthy minority, and they can devote themselves to political careerism. The last people who should be given power are those who are seeking power. Politics ends up being really a matter of image and projection. Factions with their own personal interests pretending to speak for the people. They use these vague abstractions. This is the bondage from which monarchy saves the nation. States are far more authoritarian today than they ever were in the Russian autocracy. But the prejudice, just that word, autocracy, authoritarianism versus democracy, that creates these emotional connections. And people, that short circuits their reason. Politicians are as ignorant as the people who vote for them. And that, in very general terms, is the core of the argument of Nikolai Chernyev. I thank you, everyone. I appreciate you listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.